ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For decades, a mystery has haunted Tamworth.
Mark Anthony Haynes' body was discovered on an isolated stretch of train tracks.
No one talked about him. He was just another little black fella.
An ABC True Crime podcast was followed by a fresh inquest.
Someone was just holding their breath.
If he didn't do it directly, he knows what happened.
With the truth closer than ever, hear the whole story now. Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
She's kind of bouncing on the chair, really euphoric because obviously she'd won something.
So my husband might have had an obsession with drinking, but for me I had an obsession about him and his addiction.
I like to think about who she would be without the gambling, and I grieve that more so than I grieve who she is with the gambling.
Acceptance is an active thing that we can do where we look at all the discomfort in front of us and say, okay, I am choosing to do this.
I make decisions which are good for me, and they might sound a bit selfish, but once I back off trying to control him, my life's a lot better.
Addictions and disorders don't happen in a vacuum. There is the person at the centre of the storm, but there are also those around them who are swept up in the swirl. Whether it's a partner, sibling, a parent, a child, or even a friend who has a substance use or gambling disorder, the fallout for those people can be devastating. According to the Department of Health, 1 in 6 Australians are addicted to illicit drugs. And for alcohol, it's 1 in 10. And when it comes to gambling, as many as 1 in 5 experience gambling harm, either from their own gambling or from someone else's. So who's looking after these people at the centre of the storm? According to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, 70% of primary carers are women. And according to a 2024 report from the University of Canberra and Carers Australia, female carers are more likely to experience loneliness and psychological distress than male carers. So how can you love someone with an addiction and look after your own mental health at the same time? In this episode, you'll meet women who have had to redraw the boundaries of their relationships and learn how to put themselves first. I'm Yumi Steins, ladies. We need to talk about loving someone with an addiction.
She's somebody who will give you good advice, and some of the advice that she would give you is to respect yourself and to always put yourself first.
I want you to meet Edonna. She's 29, and the woman she's describing here is her mum.
She's bright, she's bubbly, her face is lit up. She goes out and about and goes for walks and is just very lively.
Oh, she sounds great.
Yeah.
There's another version of Adonna's mum, though, one who is addicted to gambling. Adonna is an only child, and a lot of her childhood was spent waiting while her mum used poker machines.
Mum's in the pokey machine room and, you know, I should probably not have been there.
Who would you talk to while you're sitting there?
The bar staff mainly. I would love the attention because people would say, oh, you're so smart and you're so mature. And obviously I think I was mainly craving that kind of attention from my mum.
Did you think it was normal at the time, Adonna?
I knew that it was my normal and, like, I had to deal with the cards that I was dealt with. But I didn't think that it was fair.
Adonna has a lot of memories from her childhood where she took a back seat to her mum's gambling, including one particular New Year's Eve.
We ate food, we celebrated the New Year, and I laid down because I was really tired. And I was dozing off and I could hear my mum kind of saying to the person who lived there that she wanted to leave and to leave me there. I remember vividly, like, sitting up and saying, like, no, I'm awake.
Adonna's mum was going out to gamble.
And mum's like, no, it's okay. I'm just going to go and I'll come back tomorrow. And it was one of those moments where everyone in the room didn't know what to say.
How did you feel in the moment?
How did I feel in the moment? I remember feeling like this really hard kind of pressure in between, in my chest, in the center of my chest, and it felt like a rock. It's something that's still kind of, I still feel, and I don't know if it's, it can also be associated with rage, and I feel like that burning heat pulling up into my chest and that heaviness. I think I feel a bit betrayed because, like, yeah, it hurts to see her kind of choose something else over me.
It wasn't just time and connection that Edonna lost. It was also one of the most primal of all human needs, the need for security. Her mum was in a constant cycle of debt.
She wasn't aware of where her money was going, and she wasn't aware of the amount of money she was going to need. And she wouldn't pay back the money that she would borrow, right?
Mm.
And so then after not paying back the money that she had borrowed, she would go and gamble again, and it was just a really bad cycle of losing money and borrowing money.
You know, I think that part of loving someone who has an addiction is trying to understand their behaviour. Have you ever tried the pokies?
Yes, I have.
What was your reaction to it?
I don't like it because I can see the draw to it.
Yeah, sure.
Mm.
I know exactly what you mean. You can feel your body reacting to the allure.
Yep.
Edonna knew the power these machines had over her mum. One day when she was 18 and at uni, Edonna couldn't get hold of her mum on the phone.
I call and I call and I call, and of course she's not answering. So I think to myself, where could she possibly be?
Edonna's intuition suggested that her mum might be on the poker machines at the pub near her uni. So she went to look for her there.
And as I'm going down the stairs, I see my mum, and I hear her actually before I see her. I hear her going, oh, come on, come on, yes, yes, like to the machine essentially, like talking to this machine, trying to will it to give her more money than it was. I stopped at the bottom step and I just stared at her, and I was angry. I was so angry. I'm just standing there looking at her, and she's like rubbing the screen, kind of bouncing on the chair, really euphoric because obviously she'd won something.
Right.
And not even aware of her surroundings, to the point that I'm standing like, what, 2.5 metres away from her, and she can't even see me.
Eventually, Edonna coaxed her mum away from the machines.
Once we left the actual pokey area and went upstairs into the real world with fresh air, she took this big sigh and looked at me and kind of blinked a few times like she'd been coming out of a trance.
Seeing the adult, you know, parent figure in your life being quite destructive, I would imagine you would feel incredibly let down and hurt.
This is Caroline Thane. She's the manager of clinical advice and governance for the Mental Health Foundation Headspace. She's had lots of conversations with the loved ones of people with substance use disorders who feel resentful.
And I think it's about recognising that you are absolutely valid in those feelings, because it is must be incredibly heartbreaking and frustrating and all of those things to watch.
Edonna isn't alone.
So we do know that 1 in 3 Australians have been impacted in some way by a person close to them using alcohol, tobacco or other drugs.
And just a reminder, when we're talking about addiction in this episode, we're also talking about harmful gambling. And according to government figures, as many as 1 in 5 experience gambling harm, either from their own gambling or from someone else's.
I think sometimes people forget that addiction is a very complex thing, and there's no one single cause or one single answer. But unfortunately, I think the stigma of caring for someone with addiction leads to people stepping back, not speaking openly and seeking support.
Would you say that all people living with someone with an addiction are carers, whether they call themselves or not?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think if you're living under the same roof as somebody with an addiction, it's likely that you're doing a lot. And I think sometimes we can fall into those roles quite subconsciously.
What do we know about loneliness for the support person?
I really feel strongly that the loneliness is about the stigma and about not reaching out and talking about addiction, because of that fear, that really strong fear of I'm going to be judged in this, even though it's not my personal addiction. I'm going to be judged and my family member who I love is going to be judged. So I'm just going to not talk about it. And that fear and judgment, of course, then sends, you know, you can internalize all those things and it can feel incredibly lonely.
What should someone do if they suspect that someone they know or someone they love has an addiction?
I think it's really important to be mindful of your own feelings in it, because if you start a conversation with someone and you're really anxious or you're really distressed, it's highly likely that conversation's going to be quite defensive and guarded or even, you know, aggressive when you're feeling particularly upset, especially if you feel like it's been hidden from you or if you have some of those thoughts of feeling betrayed or let down, which of course are normal feelings to hold and have as a human. And then it's about starting the conversation with curiosity. So don't assume that you understand why somebody has an addiction or even if they have an addiction.
Addiction can look very different depending on the person.
So why one person drinks is why one person drinks, for example. So you would start the conversation with curiosity and then transparency. So you can then model to them how you're feeling and that this is a really hard conversation. So then that actually opens up the door for vulnerability, honesty, and actually working together and walking sort of side by side, I guess. I also think it's important that as a carer, you don't feel like it's your responsibility to terminate the addiction or to cease the, whether it's drug and alcohol use or whether it's gambling, that it is totally on you to just cease that habit.
Yeah. Is there a fine line between support and enabling?
Support is actually recognising the complexities in the addiction, so the harms that are being caused and talking about those things and supporting to minimise the harm. Whereas enabling, I would say, is much more about being aware of the harm and allowing that harm to continue.
How do you not feel resentment if the person you love keeps making choices that put their addiction first above everything else, including you?
Oh, I think it would be really hard not to feel that way. It's about recognising that you are absolutely valid in those feelings, because it must be incredibly heartbreaking and frustrating and all of those things to watch.
I just wanted to ask you about grief. You know, when you've got this person that you love so dearly, they're clearly not living up to their potential and you have to set boundaries that you wouldn't set if they didn't have the addiction. Is there a lot of grief in day-to-day life for those carers, and is there grief when they finally say goodbye if that's their choice?
Yeah, definitely. I think sometimes we think grief and loss is just about somebody dying, but actually grief and loss can be about a grief of a life that you thought you were going to live and lead.
Yeah.
And so it's even bigger than the individual in front of you that has the addiction. It can be about, gosh, how did my life end up here and how did they end up here?
It's like having a newborn in the house.
This is Victoria. She's 61 and lives in Sydney. Back when her kids were young, it was her husband's drinking, not her young children, that kept her up at night.
You sort of half sleep and you hear things go bump in the night. Yeah, I was just hypervigilant.
What was the expectation or the fear?
It'd be a smoke alarm going off. Things in the kitchen he'd be cooking of a night, just hoping everything's all right. You know, when the stove goes on, you don't know whether he's going to be asleep on the floor and things happen.
Yeah. When you come down the stairs and you know he's been drinking a lot, who are you confronted by? Who's the person? Who's in his body?
He's my husband and somebody I care about and love, but, you know, there's that feeling in your heart where you go, okay, you know, here we go.
Wow. Was it most nights?
Yeah, most nights.
After these nights, Victoria would wake and survey the damage.
And either get him up or clear up bottles and drinks and things and, just try and, hide it from the kids.
Victoria's husband was what she describes as a functional alcoholic. He was a musician, so he'd work late nights and she was the main breadwinner for the family.
a great father, very involved with the kids, very handy around the house. We had a good little setup, really, and I'd work in the day. He'd do the shopping and the washing and get the kids from school, and he was very functional.
But then there was a point when her husband's drinking ramped up.
They say that alcoholism is a progressive disease, and, you know, you're not arrested from that compulsion to drink, and over time it just gets worse and worse.
Tell us about some of the ways that you would try to get your husband to stop drinking.
Sometimes write a note and leave it on the kitchen bench for when he got up in the morning and told him what he should be doing or not doing. So once I came home from work and I berated him and told him, if you really love me and your family, you would stop drinking.
Victoria tried to show her husband how his drinking impacted the family, but she now looks back with some regret at the things that she did.
I remember taking a photo of him when he's on the ground and coming home from work and showing him that, and that's just not helpful.
Victoria also made it clear to her husband that sex was off the cards if he was drunk.
And he didn't like that, but I knew for me, if I wasn't enjoying sex when he was drunk, well, and I'm not going to engage in it.
Yeah, sure. I think that's fair enough. And was that an incentive for him to drink less?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Not at all. I think it actually made him drink more and probably...
Because he was annoyed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the door slamming and the drawer slamming and the stomping the feet.
Victoria had grown up with a father with an alcohol use disorder. And she was tough on herself for what she thought of as repeating the patterns of her childhood.
I'd get up and get dressed and go to work and try to put on this mask. It was shame for me about, you know, if I grew up with this, how could I, what am I doing here again? You know, with the kids, I didn't want them to see their dad like that. And I think for me, just looking at what alcohol can do to a person.
So did your kids ever notice the drinking?
Oh, for sure.
Okay.
They were very accepting of Dad as well. And I remember talking to my son. And he would, yeah, we'd all minimise it. Minimise it that it was okay.
You're having some feelings. What's it bringing up?
It's just sadness. Sadness for all of us as a family that we had to go through it.
While there was an immense sadness, there was also love.
I used to actually say to my mum, Mum, why do you stay with Dad when he's like this? And she'd say, oh, but I love him. And I felt I was feeling the same as my mum. I would just use the word disappointment. Disappointment that how have I got myself here? Disappointment in myself and that I felt so powerless over what was happening.
Acceptance is an active thing that we can do where we look at all the discomfort in front of us and say, okay, I am choosing to do this.
This is Caroline Thain from Headspace again. She says there is a lot of power in making peace with your specific circumstances if you love someone who has a substance use disorder or is addicted to gambling.
We assume that acceptance is this passive stance of sort of rolling over and going, I cannot. But it's not this passive stance.
Acceptance in this context is focusing on what you will and won't accept and what shape your relationship with your loved one will take.
I am choosing to accept that for whatever reason or reasons usually, you aren't able to take steps or you won't take steps to support yourself. And so this is what my role is going to be. So that's like an active acceptance of these are the things within my control. These are the things within your control, and I accept by looking at them squarely in the eye that you're not going to do these things, and this is how I am going to protect myself, and that might be I cannot keep supporting you, or I can only support you in these ways, or it's actually I have to take some time and step away for a period of time.
Gosh, it's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really hard to let go of that idea that you can change someone and you can love them into rightness or into a cure.
Yeah, and I think part of that is really trying to understand the function. So for some people, it's about managing their own emotional discomfort. For others, it's about a social aspect of their life that's actually just got out of hand, or it's a way they feel like they can connect. For other families, it might be that they didn't have that literacy and they thought it might actually improve their wealth if it's gambling, for example. And I think sometimes it's also about that anxiety for that partner or family member that what are people going to think? What are they going to think of you? What are they going to say about you? And what does that mean about me?
Caroline, the people that I've seen with addictions haven't even really ever admitted that they have an addiction. So how are you supposed to help them when they're still in denial?
Oh, yes. Look, I think it's really difficult, honestly. I think you can talk about plainly and factually how you see it impacting on their life. And I think part of the challenge can be people saying, but I like that that's how I'm living my life.
Mm-hmm.
And that is my choice, which is true, of course. And then you have to think about what's within your circle of control around how you want to turn up to them, knowing that they're aware of these behaviours and it's how they want to be in the world. And then your choice is, okay, well, how do I maintain this relationship with them? Do I want to maintain this relationship with them?
Back to Adonna, the young woman whose mother is captivated by the pokies. Last year, she convinced her mum to go to counselling with her. Adonna didn't tell her mum that counselling was for people affected by gambling, so they skirted around the topic for the first three sessions.
And on the fourth session, I had brought up gambling and the counsellor was questioning me about that. And then when she did hear gambling and pokies, she swung her head around at me and said, "What? I don't gamble. Why would you say that? Why are you lying?" And got up and left the room and never came, like didn't come back to counselling after that.
Have people suggested that you don't engage with her anymore, like cut her off or get some separation between yourselves?
We had a period where I have actually cut her out of my life when I was in my late teens. And then I let her back into my life. And a few years ago, we were going through a really difficult time interpersonally, my mum and I. And so I had friends and family saying, if you were to not speak to your mother again, nobody would blame you and we would all understand why you did that. And so I kind of had this moment where I felt like I had to and I wanted to choose, what do I want to do now? Do I want mum in my life or do I not want mum in my life?
Adonna had come to understand that as much as she wished she could, she was never going to have the power to change her mum or to pull her away from her addiction to poker machines.
And I grieve that more so than I grieve who she is with the gambling. In my dreams, my relationship with my mum looks like going for walks together, doing activities together, spending time together, talking to each other, going travelling. She's like my favourite person. So everyone wants to spend time with their favourite person.
Mm. It's lovely how much you love her.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Do you think you'll ever have that with your mum, going for walks?
No. No, I don't. I've tried so hard, so very hard, and I don't think I will. So maybe I'll get a dog.
11 years ago, Victoria was in her 50s and had been living with her husband with a substance use disorder for almost 30 years. She convinced him to come with her to see a psychologist.
And I said, "You've got to do something about his drinking," and I was crying and upset. The psychologist just ignored my husband and spent all the time in that session focusing on me and saying, "Well, you should go to Al-Anon." And I thought, hang on, I haven't got a problem. He's got the problem. And I sat on that for a few months.
Victoria had spent decades waiting for her husband to change, but the psychologist's words made her realise that change could come from her.
A few months after that appointment, she went to her first Al-Anon meeting. Al-Anon, by the way, is a support service for family and friends of people with alcohol and drug use disorders.
I was pretty nervous because I thought somebody might know me, because I'd sort of been living a secret. You know, everything looked fine at home on the outside, but inside it wasn't. And in that room, there were people who knew my story, and I heard them sharing, and I heard them say things that I could relate to.
What sort of things were they saying?
Yeah, things like the three C's. I didn't cause it, I can't control it, and I can't cure it. And I thought, yeah, I really related to that one. Mm. They really taught me to focus on myself. And I believe I was suffering from an obsession. So my husband might have had an obsession with drinking, but for me I had an obsession about him and his addiction.
Sure.
And trying to fix and rescue and solve that. And Al-Anon taught me, back off, keep the focus on yourself. And my life's changed for the better since. There's a little saying that says, let it begin with me. And it might sound a bit selfish, but once I back off trying to control him, my life's a lot better and my mental health is a lot better.
One of those decisions was to stop living with her husband. 7 years ago, he moved out.
I choose not to live like this anymore.
Was that hard to do?
For sure. I'd been with him for 30 years, but he only lives 5 minutes away.
Can you describe what the relationship between the two of you looks like now?
Now there's care between us. We both care about each other. If we need something, I need you to take me to the doctor or the hospital, whatever, we can do that.
Mm.
I don't know what he does day in, day out. I don't want to know.
Do you picture his future?
I try not to forecast what's going on in the future. I don't think that's helpful. And for me, it's stay in the day and be grateful for what I've got today. If I spend my time crystal balling, I think that's a waste of time.
Victoria learned about the concept of loving detachment in her support group, and it's been helpful in maintaining a relationship with her husband.
It's about, yeah, still caring about a person, but allowing them to get on with their own life and giving them the dignity to make choices for what's right for themselves. You know, who am I to judge and, you know, you live to my standards and my expectations? No, this is your life and let them go.
Yeah.
And that's very freeing.
It must be very freeing.
I sleep a lot better now. I get on with my life and I'm doing all sorts of things that I never dreamt that I would be doing. I travel on my own. I love the freedom of not worrying about what somebody else is doing. And for me, I'm much happier.
Well, goddamn if there isn't an ocean load of wisdom from today's guests that we can all learn from, whether or not we love someone with a substance use disorder or gambling addiction. No matter what our circumstances, we probably all love or like or are related to people who absolutely do not follow the path that we would choose for them. And it can be wildly upsetting to watch loved ones repeatedly make harmful choices. What we can do about that is, we can let it begin with me. We can begin by making choices that are good for us. As our first response and as our first decision. And that doesn't mean living with audacious self-centeredness, nor does it mean excising that person from our lives like a tumour. It may just mean putting the oxygen mask on ourselves first. For support for yourself or a loved one, there are a bunch of resources in the show notes. And a huge thank you to Dr. Steph Kershaw from the Matilda Centre for Research in Mental Health and Substance Abuse at the University of Sydney for her help in putting together this episode. This podcast was produced on the lands of the Gundungurra and Gadigal peoples. Ladies We Need to Talk is mixed by Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. It's produced by Elsa Silberstein. Supervising producer is Tamar Cranswick. And our executive producer is Alex Lolbach. This series was created by Claudine Ryan.